Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the plans announced Thursday by the Trump administration to freeze fuel efficiency requirements on the nation's cars and trucks in a move to not just roll back efforts to deal with global warming, but to also undermine the ability of California and other states to impose standards to improve public health, combat climate change, spur new technology, and save consumers money. Jody Freeman, the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the law school's Environmental Law and Policy Program, who served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House, joins us. We will examine Trump's vengeful use of the power of the presidency that seems to be motivated more out of spite in undoing yet another Obama achievement than even acting in support of reactionary ideology or pandering to big corporations, since it is not clear that Detroit's big three auto manufacturers are lobbying for the rollback. Certainly, the reasons given by the White House make no sense on the surface, and it is clear consumers want cleaner air and better mileage and lower fuel costs. And the absurdity of Trump's claim that the California standards are hurting car sales is borne out by the fact that in the last few years, we have seen all-time record sales of cars and trucks. Then we'll investigate the latest secretive group to emerge on the far right, who were on display at Tuesday's Trump rally in Florida, where Trump supporters were wearing QAnon T-shirts, hats, and brandishing posters as they cursed and threatened members of the press, especially reporters from CNN, a network Trump regularly disparages. Will Sommer, a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, where his latest article is QAnon, the pro-Trump conspiracy theorists now believe JFK Jr. faked his death to become their leader, joins us. We will discuss QAnon's bizarre beliefs and how Trump got them started by cryptically referring to the coming storm. Then finally, we will speak with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor IV scholarship in the public interest and is the author of the new book just out, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. He joins us to discuss his article at Truthdig, Neoliberal Fascism and the Echoes of History, and President Trump's recent displays of autocratic tendencies bordering on totalitarian instincts, along with his brazen contempt for the rule of law as the president escalates his attacks on the FBI and the DOJ. And joining us now is Jody Freeman, the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the law school's Environmental Law and Public and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She has also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House, and she has an op-ed in the New York Times, Trump's biggest climate move yet is bad for everyone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Freeman.
Hi, great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Jody, and I don't imagine you're feeling good about, your article makes it clear, frankly, that this doesn't make any sense. There were so many reasons why nobody wants this. Why does Trump want it?
Yeah, it's interesting because the proposal, you know, would freeze these standards at levels far below what the Obama standards would have accomplished. And, you know, those standards were set with the auto industry's support in the first place. You know, we did the first round of them in 2010, and the auto industry was happy to have us set one uniform national fuel efficiency and greenhouse gas standard combined. So they had one thing to meet, and California bought into the deal, even though California has this long-standing right to set its own vehicle emission standards. It supported this national deal because it thought more could be achieved with a uniform national standard, right, than with California going its own way. So we had this terrific agreement that cut GHG pollution, cut conventional air pollution, improved fuel efficiency, reduced costs for consumers because they save at the pump. They don't have to buy as much fuel with efficient cars, and didn't deprive anybody of consumer choice because they could still buy any car they wanted. The deal was just that every car's got to get, car and truck, more efficient over time. So we thought it was a real win-win policy, and it also turned out to be the most important policy for climate change that the U.S. has ever adopted. So it was really a big deal at the time. And so this unraveling seems like a really pointed attempt to say that, we don't care about climate change as a policy issue. In fact, I was on the radio doing another spot today with a guy from the American Enterprise Institute who was talking the administration talking points, and he actually called greenhouse gas reductions just silly. So that gives you some insight into, you know, how little they actually care about any kind of climate policy. And I think what they're after here is just sort of sticking a finger in the eye of California, which has been leading the charge on air pollution since really the 1950s, and all the states that follow California standards, because they're allowed to do that under the Clean Air Act. And I think they're really just trying to say, we want to preempt you from doing anything to push cars to be cleaner, and we want to make sure that we can really limit greenhouse gas and fuel efficiency standards at a really low level. They froze them at 2020 levels instead of letting them gradually climb. So I think it's, if you read this proposal, and if you were to sit there and actually go through this 800 pages, which I have had to scan through several times now, you would see a lot of indications of a sort of political motivation, kind of this grudge against California, kind of these cheap shots. You'd see a lot in there that would indicate that there's some ideological motivation. It's not really driven by the facts about costs and benefits.
But the facts are that transportation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. That is a fact. And that the standards that were set are 37 miles per gallon in 2020 and 50 miles per gallon by 2025. And if this were to go ahead as planned, now that it's been frozen by Trump, it would have reduced American oil consumption by 1.2 billion barrels, cut half a billion metric tons of carbon pollution, and save consumers billions of dollars in fuel costs.
Right.
According to the EPA's own recent estimates, I'm reading from, I'm sure you're familiar with this.
Well, what's interesting about those figures is if you just boil it down, what the Obama standards did was they doubled fuel efficiency from 2010 to 2025. That was the projected goal, to basically double it. And that would be good for consumers because that would save billions of barrels of oil and, you know, make it cheaper to fuel up your car. And even if you don't care about climate change, you know, even if you don't really care about the literally billions of metric tons of carbon pollution that you're cutting, if you don't care about that at all, you still ought to care about the idea that you can save a lot of money by, you know, making sure that cars are more efficient over time. And so you should support this policy from a cost perspective. So what's puzzling is that this new proposal to freeze the standards and to preempt California's power, it's really driven by two central claims that are very flawed. One claim they're making is that more efficient cars will result in more deaths. Okay, so it's a tantamount to saying efficiency will kill people, which has been debunked, proven wrong long ago. You know, as cars have become more fuel efficient over the last 40 years, they've gotten almost 90% more efficient gradually, and deaths, fatalities have been reduced by two-thirds at the same time. So the idea that you can't have safe and efficient cars together is just wrong, and in fact, consumers should demand both of those things. And if you I'll give you one great example of what the evidence shows. So Ford, with its famous, very popular F-150 truck, they took out about 700 pounds from that truck by going to lightweight, strong aluminum material. And by doing that, they improved the fuel efficiency of that vehicle by about 4 miles per gallon, and they got a top flight safety rating. So on the ground, it's just not true that by making fuel-efficient cars, you're going to compromise safety. But the administration is really resting a lot on that argument. The second thing they do, I just want to mention, is they claim that the costs of these standards just far outweigh the benefits, and that's easy to do when you say that greenhouse gas pollution reduction is silly, because that means you don't value it at all, and it's also easy to do if you wildly inflate the costs, which they did. They sort of discounted the fact that you save a lot of money over time by saving on fuel. So there was sort of magic math in the proposal, and it makes it all look very sensible from their perspective.
And also, as I pointed out in the opening, in the last few years, we've had record car sales with these very cars that they're trying to say are hurting are less safe and are hurting the manufacturers or a burden on the manufacturers.
Yeah, they've done very well, and every year have been managed to meet the gradually increasing targets, which are averages across their fleets. So yes, it's a little puzzling. I guess, you know, just to be fair, it is possible that in the later years of these standards, like reaching out to 2023, 24, 25, it's possible that the auto industry might need to have a little bit more flexibility, you know, to deal with problems we're not fully realizing yet, you know, maybe some technology problems. And it's possible that you can give them some flexibility with the existing program. You don't have to blow it up. You can give them some more credits to make it easier to meet these standards if they need them. If they invest in sort of advanced technologies, maybe they should get extra credits. If they put out more electric vehicles and hybrids, maybe they should get a lot of credits. Maybe if they, you know, invent or invest in super efficient lighting and stuff like that, you can imagine rewarding them for that and making it a bit easier for them to meet the standards. All of that is totally doable and manageable without exploding this national program and sending it all to the courts, which is where it's going to wind up, because California, I promise you, has already pledged that they are going to go forward with their own greenhouse gas standards. And the administration has sort of tried to stop that in its tracks by saying, well, you may have always had this authority under the Clean Air Act, but we've got a reading of the law now, a new reading that in which you don't really have that power anymore. So that's going to wind up working its way through the courts.
And again, I'm speaking with Jody Freeman, who's the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House, and she has an op-ed at the New York Times, Trump's biggest climate move yet is bad for everyone. So a major legal battle is looming, as you point out in your article. And already at this point, the courts have favored these CAFE standards, and even the Supreme Court as well, although it may change, of course. But the bottom line from what I got from your article, Jody, is that the big three automakers, and I guess the European ones as well, they don't like this because a legal battle could go on for a long time, and they want certainty because they have to plan ahead on the various model years. So this thing doesn't even make any sense. I was speculating in the opening that maybe, as far as I know, the big three haven't been lobbying for this. This is coming from somewhere else.
Well, I think actually the auto industry is trying to play both sides of this. It's interesting to watch them position. And all the companies aren't the same. It's not a monolith, the industry. Some of the companies have publicly said they don't want to roll back these standards, but they do want some flexibility. Companies like Ford have said that, and Toyota and Honda. But others seem to want to unravel them, or at least take a chance. They think, and I'm speculating, that, you know, this is their best shot at trying to freeze fuel efficiency for a while, and that will allow them to sell a lot of really inefficient, really big cars and trucks that earn them a lot of profit because they have a lot of bells and whistles on them. And maybe they think this is their chance to kind of cut California off at the knees. There's a long history to this. The auto industry has long resented the fact that California got in the Clean Air Act of 1967, and in 1970 it was reinforced. They long have resented that California got a kind of special status, and Congress gave it to California because of its long leadership on air pollution. You know, California had a terrible air pollution problem in the 40s and 50s, and they started to regulate it. And they really created a model for the national approach to air pollution. And Congress said, well, you've got special problems, and you're a leader, so you alone, California, will be allowed to set your own tailpipe pollution standards for cars and trucks. We'll allow the nation to be a two-car nation. There'll be federal standards for everybody and California standards for California. And then later on, Congress said in 1977, hey, other states can adopt California standards too. So that now we have about 40% of the car market has bought in the California standards. And I think many in the auto industry for decades have long resented this. And I think some of them think, well, this is our chance with a friendly administration to get them to take a view of the way the law works, to give a legal interpretation to these laws that no one has yet succeeded with, They're going to try it again and see if they can knock out California's authority. And the argument they're making is, well, you know, there's this other law called the CAFE statute where the Department of Transportation sets fuel efficiency standards, the ones we call CAFE, that are about miles per gallon. And it says in that law that only the Department of Transportation can set standards relating to fuel economy, those words, relating to fuel economy. And this administration's argument is, oh, well, California standards relate to fuel economy. Even though they're about public health, even though they're pollution standards, they're not fuel efficiency standards. The argument is, well, they relate to it, and so they are blocked. The exclusive power belongs to transportation. This is a really aggressive argument. It's an amazing argument for the Environmental Protection Agency to make. It's ceding its power to the Department of Transportation. It's really abdicating its power. But that's the heart and soul of what's going on here. And I think some in the auto industry really want to roll the dice and want to take a chance. I just don't think it's in their long-term interest because, you know, they have to make more efficient cars to sell to the rest of the world. And California has helped propel innovation in the industry. And it's much, much simpler to have one national standard than to have regulatory fracture and litigation. So I don't think it's in their interest, and I hope they'll prevail upon the administration to change this before it gets finalized.
Well, it's hard to know that. I don't know anybody that likes breathing foul air and particularly likes their children breathing foul air. And of course, these California standards have brought about innovations like catalytic converters, and the air in California was unbreathable in the 1960s, and it's totally different today. So it's hard to understand what, just in the last couple of minutes, what can be done in terms of public pressure, people power? This is, you know, the way I see it is this is just a vengeful president who's undone everything that Barack Obama's ever achieved. He seems to be more focused and obsessed by that than he's. This is for a builder, a man who builds things. He's been tearing stuff down from day one, tearing down people, tearing down policies.
Yeah.
And there's something, I think, quite sick about it. But
well, as I said in my piece today, you know, I think this is, of all the things he's tearing down in the world of climate change and environmental protection and energy policy, this one really has the potential to be the most dangerous and the worst because of how far-reaching these standards were and how many barrels of oil they were going to save and how much cost for consumers they were going to save and how much GHG reductions they were going to achieve. So I think it's very serious. And if you ask what people can do, first of all, I think the midterms are upon us and people should, that is the midterm elections in a couple of months, and I think people should be willing to call the representatives over this. I realize there are very important other issues, immigration, and the Mueller investigation. I'm not suggesting this is the only important thing on the agenda. But, you know, it's an important policy, and people should call their representatives and make it known that they don't want to unravel this. They don't want California to lose its special status. And, you know, I might add, you should contact car dealers. You should go down to the dealership and start making your views known and phone up Ford and GM and, you know,
Chrysler Fiat,
and make it known to these companies that you're going to hold them accountable, that their PR is at stake here. If they want to unravel these standards, you don't want to buy their cars. And I think the power of the pocketbook is really important here, and there's a way for people to make themselves heard.
Well, indeed. They've been advertising a lot, the car manufacturers, exalting these achievements. So it's going to be hard for them to turn around and say, you know, it's great to pollute again and have been a big trucks and muscle cars. So I don't know how, but that would be, I think, something that really would get their attention if a lot of people wrote to the CEOs of the big three automakers.
I think they should worry if 40% of the car market has made it clear by how they voted and what they've elected to do that they want to follow higher standards, which is what's happened. I think they run a real risk of turning off a lot of car buyers in those markets, and I think you should make yourselves known.
Well, Jody Freeman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jody Freeman, who's the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She's also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House, and she has an op-ed at the New York Times, "Trump's biggest climate move yet is bad for everyone." We're going to take a brief station break. Then we'll investigate the latest secretive group to emerge on the far right.
I will try not to breathe. I can hold my head still with my hands at my knees. These eyes are the eyes of the old, shivering and bold. I will try not to breathe. This decision is mine. I have lived a full life. These are the eyes that I.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Will Sommer, a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and was a political columnist for Washington City Paper. His latest article at The Daily Beast is QAnon. The pro-Trump conspiracy theorists now believe JFK Jr. faked his death to become their leader. Welcome to Background Briefing, Will Sommer.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So, Will, just reading the title of your latest piece, I'm wondering whether I'm sort of sharing in the insanity by even speaking out this absurdity that JFK Jr. faked his own death to become the leader of this new far-right fringe group.
It is truly bizarre, and you know, I do think it's something that, you know, obviously as QAnon gets very big this week, it's getting a lot more attention. But at the same time, I do think it's worth pointing out how many people have fallen for this obviously fake hoax.
Well, but we saw at the rally that Trump held in Tampa, Florida on Tuesday, we saw this people wearing the QAnon T-shirts and hats. We saw them heckling, particularly the CNN reporter. We saw all kinds of posters that they were holding up. Even some character showed a QAnon coin with a Q on it. So there is a movement, and I don't know whether they all showed up in Florida at the rally, but presumably there's a connection between Trump and QAnon, is there not?
Absolutely. QAnon is it sort of posits a world in which Trump is constantly winning and sort of engaged in this battle against, you know, a globalist cabal. And, that's turned out to be very appealing to a certain segment of Trump supporters. They turn up and, you know, you see whole families in these QAnon shirts at the rallies. So it's pretty bizarre stuff.
So does it have its roots? Because they talk about the storm and the storm coming. There was a photo op a while back in the White House when Trump was hosting a group of military families, and he talked about the calm before the storm. And then the reporters keep saying, what storm? You know, they were speculating, are we going to go to war against Iran, for example? And then he just basically coyly said, wait and see, you know, the storm is coming. Is there a connection there? Because they keep talking about the storm. Are they taking the cues from Trump?
Yeah, exactly right. So as you say, Trump made this kind of cryptic reference to a storm that, you know, I think normal people watching that would just assume to be a weird Trump thing. You know, he likes to play with the press and kind of trick them. But believers in QAnon, it took this to mean that there was a literal storm coming in which Trump and the military were going to arrest, you know, various figures like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and send them to Guantanamo Bay. So that's the storm they reference.
So what is this OIG report that they talk about? Because a character showed up with an AR-13 in June. He drove with an armored vehicle onto the Hoover Dam and demanded that the government release this OIG report.
Sure. So there is a real-life OIG reporter, the Inspector General report from the Justice Department, that was looking into the various law enforcement agencies' handling of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. But so we knew this was going to be coming out for months, and QAnon, or the person behind it, started leaving these clues saying, you know, this is going to be the big moment. This is going to reveal so much, and sort of all the president's enemies are going to be defeated. And then the report comes out, and it's pretty boring. And so QAnon people were very upset by this. And this one fellow, as you say, you know, allegedly drove an armored truck onto a bridge by the Hoover Dam, and he was armed and, you know, sort of took over the bridge for about an hour. And since then, he's been arrested, but he keeps trying to send all these letters about QAnon. I mean, this is a person who's essentially lost his mind to this conspiracy theory.
So what is the – I mean, I suppose since we started out talking about your latest article, QAnon, the pro-Trump conspiracy theorist now believes Jake FK Jr. faked his death to become their leader. I mean, it's horrible that the next of kin of people who die, like the parents of Sandy Hook, are haunted by what Alex Jones has been saying in his bizarre conspiracy theories, and that's led to families who've lost their young children having to move out of their own homes because of these acolytes, these strange people who follow these conspiracy theories, like the character that showed up at the pizza place in Georgetown and shot the place up thinking he was freeing up child prisoners of a child sex ring run by Hillary Clinton. So when I even say all this stuff, I feel like I'm participating in a form of insanity. But what exactly, just to fill in, to connect back to your article, what are they claiming about JFK Jr.?
Sure. So sort of a segment of the QAnon crew, the supporters, became convinced that there's a big question about who is Q, who's this person leaving the clues. And I think it's pretty obvious that it's just some random person messing with these people. But they become convinced that it was someone close to Trump in the administration, or maybe even Trump himself. But then they decided, well, maybe it's JFK Jr., who, of course, died in a plane crash nearly 20 years ago. But they decided, oh, no, he faked his death, and he teamed up with Trump, and now they're going to, you know, take on the deep state. But the truly bizarre part about this is they teamed up with, or excuse me, they became convinced that this one man, a real-life person photographed behind Trump, was JFK Jr. in disguise. And so they've, you know, these unhinged people essentially are creating these conspiracy theories about some random innocent person.
But he looks nothing like JFK Jr., even even at the age of 57, which he would be now.
Right, yeah. I mean, he look, well, they say, well, he's obviously in a disguise, which, you know, I don't know how I would feel if people looked at me and they said, this guy's like, no person could look like that.
So, again, I'm speaking with Will Sommer, a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and as a political columnist for Washington City Paper. His latest article at The Daily Beast is QAnon, the pro-Trump conspiracy theorists now believe JFK Jr. faked his death to become their leader. So where are they in the kind of pantheon on the far right with people like Alex Jones, as you've told us, Will, Q himself, whoever it is, the leader of this group of conspiracists? I take it what they're saying here is that they've got an insider in the government as high up as possible, Trump themselves, and they've been able to turn everything on its head, right? Some of them say that Mueller is actually working with Trump to put Hillary Clinton in jail, and others say that Mueller is leading a child sex ring. So what is it?
Sure. So a lot of what happens in QAnon stuff is that because the clues themselves are so cryptic, you end up with a lot of factionalism, and people say, this is what it means, and they say, no, this is what it means. But a lot of times you can look at it and they say, it's essentially whatever happens in the world that's bad for Trump, they say, actually, it's great for Trump, and here's what you're missing. And so in the case of the Mueller investigation, you might say, wow, it's not great for the president that there's a special counsel investigating his campaign. But they say, oh, no, you don't understand. Mueller is really working with Trump to investigate Hillary Clinton. And it was all like a big ruse, so don't worry about it. So it's truly sort of a world turned upside down.
Well, but it has real world consequences. I mentioned the Pizzagate situation. Fortunately, the fellow didn't shoot anybody, but he discharged an assault rifle. And the Q people, or whatever, QAnons, or whatever, I don't know what you call them, were attacking Jim Acosta of CNN at that rally down in Tampa. And that's pretty scary. I've seen the footage of that. These people are really riled up.
Yeah, they really are. And, you know, it's sort of the nature of the conspiracy theory is in a way that would make you really mad if you believed in it. Because, you know, let's say you elected Trump and you're a passionate Trump supporter, and then you're told, well, the reason you're not getting everything you want, like the reason the world isn't perfect, is not because of the way electoral politics works and then the government can only fix so much. It's because of this deep state. It's all these Democrats and all these pedophiles who are kind of scheming to create all the trouble in the world. and, you know, they want to take your president out of office and all this stuff. So then you start to think, oh, no, you know, maybe, like, violent action is called for.
Well, how do you separate? I asked you about where they stand in the lexicon with Alex Jones, but there were others at this rally in Tampa with T-shirts referring to the Seth Rich conspiracy. He worked for the Democratic National Committee and was mugged and killed on the streets of Washington. And by the way, that conspiracy was largely fueled by Fox News. I don't think it would have had any legs at all, but for Hannity and others at Fox. You know, and of course, that's not the first time we've had these bizarre theories. During the Clinton era, there was the notion that Clinton killed his best friend, Vince Foster. So it's nothing new, but is there a pattern here? Does it sort of start with Fox and then go to Alex Jones and then go to QAnon?
Yeah, in many ways, the QAnon is sort of a mega conspiracy theory that has absorbed many others. So, you know, if you believe Seth Rich was murdered by Hillary Clinton, then it's not too much of a jump for someone to say, well, the reason is because of this whole deep state that works together. And one thing they did was kill Seth Rich. And another thing they did was run a pedophile ring out of Comet Ping Pong, stuff like that. And so this is sort of the QAnon is sort of the culmination of years of conspiratorial thinking on the right.
And do we have any ideas what kind of numbers there are?
You know, it's hard to tell with anything on the internet. I think it's very telling that so many people are turning up to Trump rallies in these outfits and these shirts. There was a QAnon rally in D.C. in April before this stuff really started getting big. And back then, it was like roughly 200 people showed up. But, of course, I think it's grown in size since then. And of course, that was only in one part of the country. So, you know, it seems to be pretty widespread, frankly, you know, amongst a particular segment of Trump supporters.
And what is this attack against Tom Hanks, who's sort of like, you know, the kind of all-American decent guy, at least he's cast that way in movies, you know, like Saving Private Ryan, for example. And somehow they've accused him of, what, child rape or something? And it comes from a tweet from somebody called Sarah Ruth Ashcroft, who claimed that she was purchased by Tom Hanks at the age of 13 as a dissociated mind-controlled doll. And then later, Ashcroft boasted how QAnon had helped her increase her Twitter following by 20,000. So,
yeah, I mean, these, like, QAnon, because it's so broad and because there's no real, you know, there's no leader, per se, besides the person leaving the clues, they're very prone to either disturbed people or hucksters sort of leading them in different directions. And so the latest thing, as you mentioned, has been various people showing up to say, you know, oh, I've got this proof that, you know, Hollywood is all run by pedophiles and stuff like that. And, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, frankly, people who believe in QAnon have already shown themselves to be more gullible or more impressionable, I think, than the average person, and they're very motivated to believe, to find proof of these outlandish things that they already believe in. So in this case, I think that's what's going on.
So it seems, though, I don't know whether anybody's trying to do anything about, you know, whether Tom Hanks or anybody is policing this in terms of the internet. It's sort of pretty much the Wild West, we know. But at least in terms of Alex Jones, there's a court case against him underway in Austin, Texas, from the families of the Sandy Hook victims whose lives have been ruined by, after losing their children, they've been persecuted even more by Alex Jones. YouTube and Facebook took down most of his stuff, apparently. And of course, Alex Jones then urged his followers to get his stuff on Spotify. But today, Spotify took down a lot of his stuff as well. So there is some policing going on. Is there any policing going on with QAnon?
Not really, no. I mean, these people have been very successful at getting their videos to the front of YouTube, for example. You know, and I think that's where they're picking up a lot of believers. And so, you know, at this point, it's also because it's such a faceless movement. You know, no one can sue Q because no one knows who or, you know, or what group of people that is. So whereas Alex Jones is unusual because it's a conspiracy theory person who has a company and he has an office and everything, and you can sue him and he has money. Whereas a lot of these random people, either they don't have anything worth suing over or just no one has any idea who they are.
Do they actually believe this stuff, or do you think this is a smear campaign?
You know, I think for the most part they believe it. I think there's a couple people who are kind of along for the ride, and they're just kind of trying to mess with people. But I mean, you know, I've talked to these people, and they're very earnest. I mean, they truly believe that, you know, all of this, you know, these kind of forces of evil are at work in the world and stuff. And there's also, I think, a large element, especially when it comes to these allegations of pedophilia. There's an element of sort of this kind of like Christian, this kind of this idea of good against evil, that they feel very passionately about. So I do think a majority of the people, you know, wearing QAnon stuff, I mean, they think it's real.
So do you think there's going to be, I don't know whether you watch the White House press briefings, but they're getting pretty heated lately. And I know that Sanders doesn't necessarily give satisfactory answers to the questions. But is there any sense that there are going to be some questions about this? Because if I was a reporter, particularly covering a Trump rally, being singled out by an angry crowd of these QAnon people who, let's face it, you know, believe some pretty crazy stuff, so that might put them on the spectrum to be a little dangerous, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. It sort of appeals to, I think, some unhinged people. I mean, I don't think the majority of them would be violent, but, you know, you only need one or two people for something really bad to happen. It actually did come up at the White House briefing yesterday. You know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked what the president, you know, whether he would sort of denounce this bizarre movement. And she kind of hedged and said, well, we don't want any violent movements. And I say, well, all right, but what about, you know, what about like real, like messed up stuff, even if it's not violent? And, you know, they're just kind of not trying to alienate people, apparently.
Well, people who support them, right? I mean, it isn't the
bottom
line is that this QAnon, they support Trump, right?
Yes, exactly. They're all like hardcore Trump supporters.
Right. Well, as I say, even talking about it, I feel like I'm losing a few brain cells here. So I don't know how you feel, Will, covering this stuff.
You know, I have a high tolerance for it for whatever reason.
I see. Well, Will Sommer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Will Sommer, who's a tech reporter for The Daily Beast, who previously worked as a campaign editor at The Hill and as a political columnist for Washington City Paper. His latest article at The Daily Beast is QAnon, the pro-Trump conspiracy theorists now believe JFK Jr. faked his death to become their leader. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back speaking with Henry Giroux about his new book just out, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. He's also the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Dangerous Thinking in the Age of the New Authoritarianism and The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism. And his latest book just out is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And he has an article at Truthdig, Neoliberal Fascism and the Echoes of History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Oh, it's good to be on again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Henry. And yesterday I spoke with the historian Benjamin Hett, who has a new book, The Death of Democracy, which tells the history of the rise of the Nazis in the 1920s and 1930s, and without mentioning Trump by name, has uncanny, in fact, terrifying analogies with the current political situation and this leader who just yesterday made it clear that he has, you know, we talked to politely about him having authoritarian tendencies. They were absolutely manifest. They were sort of arcing off him like a transformer blowing up. It's so clear that America is in danger because it has a leader who is dangerous. And he has enormous power. He's going to add to the pollution from cars simply because he has the power to do so out of spite. I mean, this is a frightening moment we're in. And I just don't see people being aware of the dangers. There's a peculiar kind of complacency. How do you see the current situation?
Well, I think that in part you're right. I think in many ways this kind of authoritarianism has been with us for so long that it's become normalized. What he's done is just simply ratchet it up and make it so visible that it appears extraordinary and seems less to be symptomatic than something deeper than it does to be rather something unique to this presidency. But I think one of the problems that I see around the really absolutely terrifying increasing sort of resemblances to what we might call the horrifying echoes of the past is the way the media refuses to name this. I mean, I'm just so sick of the New York Times and David Leonhardt and others saying things like, well, this isn't really fascism. This isn't really a sort of dictatorship of the sort that we saw in Germany and Italy in the 1930s, Pinochet in the 1970s. Well, actually, it's a very dumb sort of understanding of fascism, because it seems to suggest that fascism is something static historically that basically you can only sort of analyze as an historical relic, as opposed to looking at the way fascism becomes a heuristic tool to be able to understand how the basic elements of fascism really sort of redeploy themselves in different forms. And I think that in light of what you've just said, never mind, the ongoing use of his power to pollute the planet. I mean, this is a guy who is actually whipping up a mass hysteria in a kind of ultra-nationalism, but most importantly, the rhetoric of authoritarianism and the rhetoric of white supremacy and the rhetoric of violence that I find enormously frightening. I mean, think about what just happened with CNN yesterday. When the crowds at his rally were taunting the CNN reporter, yelling fake news, swearing at him, giving him the finger. And, Jim Coster, I believe is his name, and he got off, and he posted the line that this is terrifying, that the possibility for violence here against journalists. And, of course, then Trump's son, Eric, puts a tweet out supporting it, which Trump then forwarded. I mean, so I don't know how much closer we come to the basic tenets of fascism before we realize that this is not just a dangerous, eccentric moment in history, that this country is basically now on the verge of instituting a kind of fascism that, if it gets more extreme, there'll be no question whatsoever about the historical moment in which we find ourselves.
But when you mention a reporter sort of being kind of mealy-mouthed about the reality of the dangers that Trump poses, it's almost like, what is it going to take? On the program today, we discussed the attacks on Jim Acosta of CNN and also this new far-right-wing phenomenon, QAnon.
Right.
And they were all over that rally, these peculiar people with these bizarre ideas. And, it's just a matter of time before somebody in the press is either beaten up badly or even worse.
The other side of this, of course, is that, we saw this throughout the presidential campaign. I mean, his willingness, for instance, to pay the legal costs for one guy who basically had attacked an anti-Trump African-American critic as he was walking up the stairs. He has repeatedly sort of been on the verge of just outrightly legitimating violence against a whole range of groups, never mind just squelching dissent. I mean, think about what he said to those police chiefs in New Jersey when he said, hey, look, when you put the, you arrest these guys and you're putting, pushing down on their heads, he said, you know, bang their heads against the car. The police chief of the, in that town had to apologize to the press. He said, oh, wait a minute. No, no, this is not quite what we want. I mean, Trump has a notion of law and order that basically is not unlike what we'd associate with stormtroopers. I mean, this is a guy who really believes that lawlessness is the order of the day and that violence and absolute power are the ultimate essence of politics. He has emptied politics out, basically, of its democratic elements. He hates the press. He hates dissent. He hates any kind of accountability. He believes that he's above the law. He tries to disable other institutions in the government that would hold him accountable. I mean, I don't know basically where it ends. He's anti-intellectual. He has a contempt for weakness. He's a hyper-masculine guy who has a fear of the other. And the ultra-nationalism. But what is even more striking is here's a guy who is doing everything he can to insult every leader in the Western alliance, while at the same time he praises these murderous thugs who lead countries like North Korea, the Philippines, Turkey, Hungary. You know, where does it end? I mean, the guy is completely unapologetic about his authoritarian tendencies. And what's worse is that he now has the power of a Congress that basically is right out of the Vichy regime. I mean, these are real cowards. I mean, these are people who basically have no consideration for democracy, have no consideration for justice, and they follow him like lemmings. So it's a very dangerous moment. I mean, I guess that's what we're saying. I mean, of course, there are people who are recognizing this. I mean, there are groups that are mobilizing, and there are groups that basically are doing everything they can to see if they can somewhat modify this by winning the elections in 2018. But at the same time, I think the nature of this danger, and I think this is where we're going with this, it has to be named. We really have to talk about this as fascism. I mean, I use the expression neoliberal fascism because I really believe that neoliberalism has created the conditions that have made much of this possible. The economic misery, the hate, the racism, you name it. But it seems to me that until we come to grips with the fact that we now are in a form of extreme capitalism that has created such polarization and has intensified all the basic problems that this country has, that it creates the conditions that are ripe for the strong man, you know, for the authoritarian, for the fascist, who wants to really basically mobilize as much as he can, as much fear, insecurity, and uncertainty that he can.
And, of course, I can't remember who it was that said when fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in the flag and holding the Bible.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of quotes, and that's one of them. But I think the other quote that was made by Adorno, which I actually love, he says, I consider the survival of national socialism within democracy to be potentially more menacing than the survival of fascist tendencies against democracy. That's the smartest quote I've heard in a long time. And I think that's one that people in the United States have really got to start to take very, very seriously because they're basically losing their freedoms. You know, they're losing the ability to be able to understand that, A, capitalism and democracy are not the same thing, and, B, that all of a sudden what they've given up by virtue of the long-standing loss of democratic institutions since the 1970s is they've given up the ability to even name the country they live in as a democratic society. This is not a democracy anymore. Let's be realistic. I mean, the Princeton study that came out a few years ago, looking at the policies that had gone on for the last 30 years, was very clear in saying that almost 95% of those policies had nothing to do with serving the interests of the public good, and that they called it an oligarchy. They said, this is an oligarchy. You know, it's a country run by the rich. It's a country run by big corporations. I mean, the average CEO salary in the United States is $13 million a year, $12 million a year. You know, this is something that needs to be understood in all of its facets. You can't have a democracy and have something like 5% of the population, or 1% of the population controlling, half the wealth in the country. It doesn't work. The level of inequality that neoliberalism has produced this casino capitalism has generated the conditions for such precarity, such uncertainty, such fear, you know, fear of not having a job, fear of the other, fear of Muslims, you know, fear of the future, that it's created a society now that's so militaristic, so overly concerned with questions of violence as the only way to solve social problems, that law and order now becomes the quid pro quo of what it means to have any kind of exchange, that commercial relationships are the only relationships that matter, that it's not surprising that Trump resonates with a certain element of the population. Couple that with a culture that is so engrossed in civic illiteracy, so dumb in terms of its inability to take critique and self-reflection and critical education seriously, it seems like the perfect storm.
And, of course, Trump talked about the storm, and that has led to the formation of this underground lunatic far-right group called QAnon, who are waiting for the storm. And, again, I'm speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds a McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. His latest book just out is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism, and he has an article at Truthdig, Neoliberal Fascism and the Echoes of History. And I mentioned earlier, Henry, that it, not only are so much of our public and press blind to the reality of this incipient Trumpian fascism, he is in our face. It's not like he's hiding it.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, the way that he's, for example, just decided to start having cars pollute and try to weaken California's ability to move into the 21st century and deal with climate change. And by the way, the people in California do want, and other states that have signed on to the CAFE standards, they do want clean air and they don't want polluting vehicles. So he's just done this out of spite.
I think that one of the things that is always typical of authoritarian psychopaths is that in many cases, many people believe that there's an ideology at work that's very systemic that one can point to try to understand what people like them do, you know, whether it's, you know, Duterte in the Philippines, who says that he thinks now that killing journalists is just as important as killing drug dealers. But I think that like many of these dictators, this guy feeds off a kind of contempt for anyone that he sees being in opposition to him. Remember, Ian, the statement he made, which is almost basically insane. He said that those Democrats that didn't stand after his last State of the Union address probably were committing treason. He told that to one of his groups. And, you know, can you imagine committing treason? Treason is a crime punishing that can be punished by death. I mean, this guy has such a hatred of anyone who holds him accountable that my sense is that there's a side of him that doesn't even understand the pollution issue, that really doesn't believe that the damage that could be done, doesn't have the figures, hasn't done the analysis, has not looked at the literature. He's looking at California like he looks at the East Coast, and he's saying, hey, they're not on my side, let's punish them, right? I mean, let's do something awful to them. And I think in many ways, this is a politics, not just a diversion, as many people in the press argue. This is a politics of utter destruction of the enemy. The enemy being the press, the enemy of the American people. This is a Stalin's term, a term that was used to basically kill people and make them disappear. And I think that this is a term that Trump feels very comfortable with. As we know, as a result of his conversation recently with Sulzberger, the head of the New York Times, he's very comfortable with these notions. And I think in that sense, he's really very, very dangerous and getting increasingly more dangerous as he becomes more unsettled by the Mueller investigation, the possibility of what Cohen might say, and other kind of leaks that are now taking place in his administration.
Well, in terms of being in your face, Mnuchin, his Secretary of the Treasury, who's a total disgraceful toady.
Despicable man.
He is a despicable man, and even his own father won't talk to him. He just announced that they were going to find a way and jiggle the books at Treasury to give the super rich, the ultra rich, an extra $100 billion in tax cuts. This is after the tax cuts, the $1.5 trillion, that almost all went to the big corporations and the most richest people in this country. It's blown out the deficit. Revenues aren't coming in, as Trump promised, because the corporations are doing write-downs and not repatriating the money that Trump promised. The whole thing is a massive scam. But again, in your face, the idea that in the face of this vast transfer of wealth away from the poor and middle classes to the wealthy in this country, that they're going to add even more with a $100 billion gift to the super rich, you know, the arrogance of these people, I guess, is in direct consequence of our general apathy. I mean,
no, I agree with you. I think that's very perceptive. I mean, I think that one of the things that you've said repeatedly in this exchange that we're having, and I've said in my work, and certainly in the new book, that one of the things that's one of the defining characteristics of this kind of neoliberal fascism, you know, a fascism for the rich that really sort of benefits the rich in multiple ways, is the absolute lack of any kind of self-reflection about its consequences. You know, one of the basic tenets of neoliberalism is that you can divorce economic activity from social cost. As you well know, you don't have to worry about social core. It doesn't matter what the consequences are. But we've never seen it ratcheted up to the degree, like everything else in this administration, that we see now on display. Not only is there no apology, not only is there no attempt to hide this, there seems to be a certain glee, a certain cathartic kind of appropriation output in just making people suffer while having the 1% benefit. I mean, that's what I find disturbing. Suffering seems to be something that these people, mass suffering, seems to be something that these people enjoy when they produce it. It's not as if they're doing this and then going underground, right? I mean, going dark, you know, putting policies together on a weekend and then disappearing. They actually get on talk shows and say things that in any fascist country you'd expect to hear, like Giuliani saying things like, collusion is not a crime. Jesus, I mean, you're going to be kidding me. You know, is this guy insane? And we're constantly hearing this kind of language, a language that is so outside the pale or the parameters of any kind of democratic discourse that, you know, the biggest fear we have is that it becomes normalized. You know, people will say, well, no, there is no president ever who has lied the way Trump does. There is no president ever who has basically promoted and legitimated violence against his critics. There is no president who has done so much to harm the environment as this guy is doing. I mean, these are all absolutes, and they're absolutes that speak to a concentration of power that appears to be unaccountable and will do more and more to make itself unaccountable by doing more and more to dismantle whatever checks and balances are in place in a democracy to somehow prevent that from happening.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Henry Giroux.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual who currently holds the McMaster University Professor for Scholarship in the Public Interest and is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University. He's also the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Critical Pedagogy and writes regularly for Truthout. His most recent books include Dangerous Thinking in the Age of New Authoritarianism, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and his latest book just out is American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And he has an article at Truthout, Neoliberal Fascism and the Echoes of History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.